Okay.
Yeah, okay.
My name's Bernard, I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Bernard.
Welcome to Saturday morning, start of the old times, and James is going to do the preamble, and Larry's going to do how it works.
Hi, everyone. My name's James, an alcoholic.
Hi, James.
Preamble. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supported through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you.
Thank you. Alcoholic, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living or honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we're like now. If you decided that you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you're ready to take certain steps. As some of these we balked, we thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us had tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember what we deal with: alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it's too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. Where you find him now? Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took. We suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn over our will, our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and become willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ten, continued to take personal inventory when we were wrong, probably admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order, I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We're not saints. The point is we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principle we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventure before and after make it three clear, pertinent ideas. A, that we're alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would view us all.
Thank you. Thanks, Larry. So here we are. Is everyone alright? Good, good. This is the fifth time we've done this old timers weekend, and just going to do a bit of housekeeping before I hand it over back to Bernard. So this group wishes no negative atmosphere, therefore can you respect this by putting your phones in silent, no sweets, gum chewing, no texting, and no electronic cigarettes. There are toilets outside. There's no smoking in the building, so I think if you come out the building and turn left, there's a designated smoking area there. There are no planned fire drills, so if you hear a fire alarm, it will be real.
Window is where?
And then I'm just going to mention Sylvia now. So the next 2 days are happening due to a non-alcoholic lady whose passion and courage not to quit because it was raining, and she taught us to dance in the rain. Sylvia came to the first old timers event believing that the pain she was in, she would not stay too long. We had to chase Sylvia out at the end of the day, and the same again the year later. Sylvia is with us today, sat amongst us with Moira, sadly only in spirit, the love that never dies. If the chairs are empty, that is not what matters. It is our hearts filled with love and hope, whether it is in AA or Al-Anon. Before I hand the meeting back to Bernard, I'm going to say some names of the old timers who are no longer with us. Tommy G, Walter, Jesse, Jimmy A, Ron G, MS John, SAS Angry John, Babs, Michael Kevin, Fireman Colin, Cecil, Tall Mark, Pangong Reg, Taxi Gary, Wee Adam, Martin the Monk, Lockkeeper Joe, Young Maidenhead Mark, America John, Vera from Newbury, Melvin, Sheila from Bracknell, Eve of Henley, Barry of Wantage, Pat of Twyford, Guardsman John, Irish Archie, and Moira. These are just a few names, so many more are not mentioned. It is good to say that their message is still alive and living in meetings they started decades ago that carries the message to the still suffering alcoholic. This is AA today. Sitting in an old tin hut, the urn is on, chatter in the kitchen. Smoke is no longer creating smoke-filled rooms. Thankfully, smoking is outside. Others sitting, waiting as the meeting is going to start on time. Bill Wilson wrote in AA Comes of Age, page 222, AA's claim any alcoholic who continuously works the AA program has a better than 3-to-1 chance of staying sober for their lifetime. Our old timers are living proof to Bill's testament, which is being recorded. Copies will be available in a couple of weeks and will be given to all the speakers. The cost of this event has been covered by the members of the Friday Watlington House AA meetings. So please bear this in mind, and there's a tradition 7 bucket by the door. Please make sure you fold your change. Our old timers committee is still very young. Members include Thomas, myself, James, David, Neil, Larry, and Helen. And with that, I pass the meeting over to Bernard.
Thank you, James. My name's Bernard, and I've forgotten his first name. Is it Robert Nelson?
Yes.
Yeah, Robert Nelson, as his soul passed away, didn't he? Got to mention him earlier. And I'd like to welcome Tony, who's going to open up for us.
Okay. Hi, I'm Tony and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Tony.
Can we just have a moment's silence, just get our thoughts together before I start? Thank you very much. As I say, I'm Tony, I'm an alcoholic, and I speak for myself, I don't speak for AA, but AA is the most wonderful thing that's happened to me in my life, really. I came along in 1978, was my first meeting, and it was world-changing for me, but no, I didn't get the message straight away. So I'll just kick off, really, at the beginning. And I was born in the Northeast. I was born just after the war into a Northeast mining family. And to say it was tough was an understatement. And I had lots of older brothers. And I'd hear fights and punch-ups going on downstairs. And that's where I grew up in. And I remember doctors called and people stitched up. And I was always told the next morning, shh, don't say anything to anybody else outside this house. It all stays within the house. And off I went to school. And to be honest, I was a frightened kid. And that's the way it was. That's the way it was. And it was not the environment that would be allowed today, but the fact is, this was early 1950s. Now, it was so bad that I actually found things to do. I was always out of the house. I was never there. I was off having my adventures. I joined the church and I became a choir boy and a Sunday school teacher. And I seriously thought about becoming a priest. I really did. Because I loved the church, because there was nobody kicking the shit out of each other in there. You know, the people came to the church and were quite nice to each other. Whereas at home, if I went home, there'd often be, you know, the OK chorale, which I didn't care for. And this went on until I was 15. At 15, I started work. And in the Northeast, once you start work, you're classed as, oh, you become a man. You're a man now, you got your own wage and things. So, and I remember I took my first drink. It was the lads from school said, Tony, come on down, come to the dance at the top of the hill at Bolden. And they said, you know, girls are there and blah, blah, blah. So I got myself smartened up and everything. And we called into an off license, and I was 15, and we got a bottle of Newcastle Brown Ale and a bottle of Amber Ale for me. So you need a couple of bottles. And I drank that on the bank outside the dance, on the grass outside the dance at Bull and Corrie. And that, I can remember it now, I remember what happened. I had just drank the elixir of life for me. So instead of feeling timid, frightened, all the rest of it, I felt fantastic. I felt like Joe Louis. I felt like Don Juan. It filled every hall. And my life changed that night. My life changed. And within 3 or 4 weeks, the church, the choir, all of it went out the window. Music lessons, everything. And I'd found what really made me feel good. Basically, I was tall, I was working. And I used to go in pubs and I used to play dominoes, can you believe this? And darts and all that. And I thought I was home. I thought, this is it. And that's where it was. And I was quite a good footballer. And I got a trial for North Shields to play for them. And a lot of us went down there and we didn't get picked up. But the fact was, I preferred booze and girls more than being in the football team. You know, football wasn't as manic as it is now. And I carried on drinking. I remember one night, which was night change, and I came home from a football match, and I was tired, I was knackered. And we'd had a great game, a local derby. And I remember sitting at my table, and I fell asleep eating my dinner. I was so tired, and I fell asleep. And my dad attacked me, because he thought I was drunk, because, you know, he'd seen me going out drinking. And my dad was a very sad sort of individual, really. He'd been involved in the Second World War, and he didn't have a clue how to bring a family up. He's a good provider, but he wasn't good with the cozy love, hug, and all that business. He wasn't any good at that at all. And he attacked me that night, and I reared up, and a big fight happened. My uncle got involved, my father, and I was a young, strong lad. And a lot of thumping went on, and I left home that night. I just packed the bag, I said, stuff it, I'm off. And I lived in Gateshead Park for 2 nights, because I didn't have anywhere to stay, and I had an apprenticeship going. And I managed to find some digs in Durham Road in Gateshead. And these were really rough digs. Because you imagine, I was on very poor wages. And the people I lived with were bin men, people straight out of prison. The second night I was in there, the police raided the house and stuck me on a bed and frisked me. And they were looking for somebody. They were looking for the landlady's boyfriend, who did turn up the next night after the police had been. Anyway, that's how I lived. And I lived there for quite a while. And I decided when I finished my apprenticeship, I really wanted to get away. I wanted to get away from Bolden. I wanted to get away from all of it. And I thought I'd come to London. I came to London with 10 quid in 1969 in a car. I battered all of Morris Thales. And I came and I got stuck in. I went to the union branch because I was a member of the union then. I said, what's the best job in London? And they said, Guinness for Bury, but you'll never get in. You know, it's all the men from the war, the sailors, the soldiers, that's who only gets in there. And that was true, but the thing was, I was quite well qualified, because although I've been a drunk in many things, I've always carried on with my studies in college. And I actually had a full tech And when I applied, I got an interview the next week, and I got straight in. Now, for an alcoholic, it was paradise in a brewery. Maintain a brewery, fantastic. And you were dished out 3 bottles minimum a day, and lots of people didn't drink, lots of people didn't want them, and I helped them out. And my drinking changed because I remember going on shift one morning at 6 o'clock, and I seen this old boy there shaking his hands, shaking, getting the top of Guinness off. And I thought, holy shit, I'll never get as bad as that. And, you know, within a period of time, I found it quite normal to have a drink at up at 6, 7 o'clock. It was either a long day, I'd have a drink. And I was in a brewery, wasn't I? And I didn't see a problem with that. Now, I've met my wife in Hammersmith Pally, and I got married, and she was a nice girl, completely different to me. And we bought our first house together, and I steadied down for quite a while. I still drank too much, but I loved my drink. I loved the smell, the taste. It rang every bell. But I carried on with my schooling, because obviously a lot of people in that brewery were old men, or people who were what they call electricians' mates and all this sort of stuff. And they were offered school to get qualified, and they didn't want it because they're too old. So I said, can I have it? And I managed to go to Harrow, and I managed to get the degree level in electrical engineering, which is good. I mean, I was far too overqualified for that job, but I'll come on to that. But my drinking was still bad. And I could cause riots. And I remember one night I had a punch up in the club, and there was this big bloke, he was a bully, and I went out, took him outside, and they closed the whole bloody club down. You know, because seeing all this mad mob out in the grass fighting, and they didn't want us back in. So I was a bit browned off with that, but I went home. Now, the crazy thing is this. It was only a few months later, there was a bad accident in Africa, and there was 3 men killed. And Guinness asked me, would I be prepared to go to Cameroons in Africa? Because I, on paper, I had everything. I had the degree, I had all the experience. You know, I was known in Port Royal when I was clean and sober. I was good at my job. And asked me, would I like to go? And I remember all the blokes I worked with said, no, it's fine. You know, because it was paradise where I worked at Port Royal. I mean, you got paid. You know, it was just for an alcoholic, it was paradise. Anyway, so I went off to Cameroons, and I arrived in Douala, and I was shocked. Everybody came to the airport to meet me because, you know, there was problems in the brewery, and the problem was they had a lot of highly qualified people from Oxford and Cambridge, but they didn't have many people who could actually do anything. You know, actually could get down there with the troops and start sorting things out, and that's what I did. And they were delighted I was there. And for an alcoholic going to the tropics, working for a brewery, maintaining a brewery, and building a new brewery, it is paradise. I mean, even the civilians drink. Even the MD's wife would have a glass of wine in lunchtime and all that. So you could hide very, very easily. Well, everything was fine, and my wife fell for our baby, and she had to go back to England. The company said, no, she can't have it in West Africa. You know, the facilities aren't good. She's got to go home. And this was 1976. And so she went home, and I thought, champion. I can now drink in peace. I won't have her squawking every night. I can have a drink and just enjoy it. And boy, did I. Boy, did I. And this carried on until one day I collapsed at work, and I was under 10 stone in weight. And just before that I collapsed, I was drinking, and I had a house, big house, big swimming pool, a steward. And I remember this steward saying to me, because my wife had left all these lists for food, Monday this, Tuesday that, Wednesday that, and he'd cook all this food. And all I would do was drink when I came in. And I don't know why, but I was drinking red wine then, which is not my drink, but I was drinking red wine. I remember sitting this lunchtime in my house, and a beautiful swimming pool out there, sunshine, and I started to cry. I was sitting all there by myself, and I realised I was dying. You know, I was dying. I couldn't stop drinking. But by the time the red wine had kicked in enough, I thought, great, I'm off, let's get rocking and rolling again. And I said, okay. As I said, I carried on for a bit longer, and then I collapsed. And I was carted off to a hospital in Douala, and this French doctor said in his best English, "Monsieur, your liver is very tired." I was 28 years old. And he said, your liver's really bad shit. But of course it was, because I've been drinking day and night for months. Anyway, cut a long story short, my daughter was born, and I decided I don't really want this, because I wanted to go back and see my wife in hospital. And they said, "Oh no, old chap," because the bullshit was still there above me, you know, the expatriate grandeur. And they said, "Oh, you're not high enough in the company." I says, "Well, stuff the company, I'm off." And I resigned. And the thing was, they were pleased, because they had seen me come so well. When Tony was clean and sober, I did a fabulous job. I did do a good job. I'm always been good at my job. But once I started drinking, the game was up. I remember during the time there, a snake had got into the buzz bar chamber, the main buzz bar to the plant, and it blew itself up and blew the buzz bars. And I spent 2 days and nights turning them over, getting it to work again. And I remember my boss coming in, who was an Oxford Blue, saying, "You've done a wonderful job." But he said, "Can you not drink so much?" And I thought, "You cheeky bastard. You know, I'd worked 2 days and two nights to get this done." Okay, I was pissed. Well, I wasn't pissed, but I was just sodden drunk. I'd been drinking all the time. Anyway, cut long story short, I came back to England. And this was 77. And, you know, I was qualified, and I got the offer of 3 jobs. And I took a job at Firestones with Brentford. And again, typical alcoholic. First 3 months clean, sober, doing the job. And normally that's when we start drinking more. But I didn't. And something changed when I came back from Africa, because out there I was drinking open the whole time. I wasn't drinking at home. I was drinking at work. I was drinking in the bars. I never hid anything. I didn't. But when I came back to England, I did. I used to buy a quarter bottle of vodka and stick it in here. And, you know, so when I went out with the civilians and my wife's friends, who, you know, very deep pockets, didn't want to buy rounds, it used to piss me off. I could have a little top up in the toilet. And I remember one night I came home from work on a Friday night and I had I bought a party four and a bottle of vodka, half bottle. And I hid it behind the settee, the half bottle, and I opened the party four and I had a little drink of that. And I fell asleep. I was very tired. And I went to bed. The next morning, my wife was doing her hoovering, which she did a lot of. And she found this vodka. And she said, "What's this?" I said, "Oh, that's for you, pet." I said, "You know, I know you like Bacardi and Coke and Bacardi and vodka. So I thought I bought it for you," which was not true at all. It was for me. I'd forgotten. I was very tired. And this is where it went on. And for the next 18 months, I carried on drinking. I did very, very well in that company, and I ended up in charge of all engineering within 18 months. And my boss said to me, "There's a big problem with GEC. We need this big motor and gearbox for shutdown. Or, you know, cause, you know, we had big shutdowns, and if it didn't come in, we were in deep shit." So he asked me to fly up there and sort them out, because this American thought the world of me, because he didn't see me drinking very much. But he only saw my work, and my work was good. So I flew up there, and I was picked up at the airport by a chauffeur-driven car, taken to the plant, and it was a nasty, nasty meeting. And refused to see me, and I just got solicited on it in London. And it all, quite a long story, took 5 hours. But at the end of it, everything I went up to do, I achieved. I explained to him about the contract, and that, you know, getting paid very well, and if you didn't deliver, it would cost us hundreds of thousands, and you're going to pay for it. So go on, nasty, but it worked out well. And I went back to Bradford Leeds in the car with the driver, and he says, "Sir, your plane has just taken off." And I thought, champion, I can have a drink now. Come on, I'm entitled to it. You know, I really am entitled to this drink. And I got to the bars at Bradford Leeds, and the bloody bars weren't open. Can you believe that? And then they did open, and I had about 5 pints, and then I got on the aeroplane. And I drank on the plane. I drank at Heathrow Airport, and I thought, well, I better drive home. And remember, I've got my best suit on, shirt and tie, briefcase, and I get in my car and I'm heading off towards Amish. Now, I hadn't been living in this house long since I got back from Africa, and I stopped to get directions on the way in nearly every pub. When the police arrested me, stopped me and arrested me, they wanted me to blow in a bag, which I wouldn't. They wanted me to give them a sample, which I wouldn't. And I said, I'm a businessman on a trip. And I says, yes, I've had a couple of drinks, but I'm all right. I was pissed. And they took me down to the police station. And I wouldn't give them nothing. Doc was called. And I remember, I was drunk. There was a lot of coppers around me, a lot of people. And I wouldn't give them an inch. And they said, we'll run you home in the police car. And I said, no, because I lived in this big house in Amish, four bedroom, detached, all the rest of it, nice estate. Don't want you bastards there. And so they said, well, we'll call a taxi. And they called a taxi, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and two jackal lads came in a taxi. And the police insisted I paid them, which I did. And I got in the taxi, and I'm heading home, and I'm thinking, Christ, I've got my car, I'm going to be somewhere else, all the rest of it. Anyway, cut a long story short, a couple of miles from my house, they're saying, this is further than what you told the police. We want more money. So I said, no, stop the car. And I stopped the car. Well, they stopped the car. I got out the back, and he, Jack, I got out the front, and he grabbed my coat, and I exploded, because he didn't realise he was dealing with a drunken madman. And I smashed his nose, and I the other bloke got out, and I left him under the number plate of the car, and I staggered off. And I staggered home, and I rang the doorbell. My wife was up; she knew all this was going on, even though I didn't know she knew. And she screamed, because there I was in my best suit and tatters, my shirt, my tie around the back, and I'm covered in blood. And she's cleaning me up, and I've got a mark on me. And while all this is going on, police car arrive. And you know, my state loved that. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning then. And they want the statement. I give them a bit of a statement, but I was too drunk. They'll say, we'll talk to you in the morning when your husband's sober. Now, I only tell you that story because it's a war story, but it's a story just to explain to you that when I was clean and sober, I was good at my job, very good at my job, but once I took my drinks, the game was over. I changed it to something else. It wasn't long after that, my wife couldn't stand it. She left, took my daughter and went, and she said, I'm not going back unless you go to AA. And I says, what are you talking about here? She says, well, I go to Allen on a Thursday night. Now, I was honestly convinced that she was going to Amersham sewing lessons and sticking buttons on shirts and things. But she hadn't been. She'd been going to Al-Anon, and I didn't know that. And she says, there's a meeting at Amersham. And she says, unless you go, I'm not coming back. And I thought, blimey, I'm not that bad. What's the matter with you? And I went down there. And I remember I couldn't drive because Her Majesty had banned me from driving. And I went on my bike, and I parked the bike outside the AA meeting. I thought, Jesus, this is great. I'm leaving a decent bike here outside this meeting. These alkies will nick this. You know, that'll be 10 pints within a minute. And I went into the meeting, and I took my mobile bar, which is my briefcase, which I had long life in, and a bottle of scotch. And I sat at the back, and an Irish bloke, Tom, did the chair. And young David was in the secretary. And Tom shared, and I'll be honest with you, for the first time in my life, somebody was talking the way my head works. You know, how my head works, how he did this, and then he would go out and drink, and he'd end up in parks and all that. And I'm listening to this bloke, and I thought, blimey, yeah, this is something. You know, this is, I'm glad I heard him. But I want to leave. I want to escape. So at the end of the meeting, I want to slip out the door. But there's all these women, Ricky Ann and Big Sue and all this, and they're coming up and talking to me and giving me a cuddle. and all this. And Big Pat came up, and I thought, blimey, what's all this? You know, is this some sort of swinging club afterwards? You know what I mean? And they're all very nice. And I said, well, I can't get the meetings because I can't drive. I'm on my bike, and Beaconsfield's a bit too far. I have a car. I'll take you. I thought, oh, bugger. You know, and the day they took my number, they wouldn't let me escape, and they took me to meetings, and I didn't want any of that. Anyway, cut long story short, I went, and I couldn't understand why my wife left me, because, you know, she had a round car, she didn't work, she had plenty of money, and I had a big house in Amersham nearly paid for, so she was well off, really, and but she couldn't stand it. She found the courage that she couldn't stand this drinking any longer. So I had to get cracking. I had to get to meetings. And what I found out quite quickly was I started to go to these meetings. And when I was in the meetings, I felt great. I felt great because my friends all felt the same way. Nobody's judging me, and it was good. But when I went away on business to Amsterdam or Europe or wherever it may be, my group wasn't there, my sponsor wasn't there, my wife wasn't there. Nobody was there except me. And if I went out and drank, the only person that got hurt was me. And I did. I did drink. And I'd take very important people out with me who wanted me to buy their production lines for my factory. And they couldn't believe it. That this hard-nosed businessman at work was just fall-down drunk, causing riots in restaurants, touching girls up, and also just drunk. And they couldn't believe it. And that's the way it was. And it went like that for 18 months. For 18 months, every time I went abroad, I thought I was escaping. I could have my little drinky poos. And each time it got worse. And it got worse in a holiday, because I worked so hard, I didn't get many holidays. And I took my wife on one of these four-day deals to Spain. And I'd gone on a two-day bender. And when I came to Earth to come back to civilization, after a row, I was in a mess, and I fell down this marble staircase and I smashed my head wide open, and I'm laying on this bed, and my wife's here and my little girl's there, and my wife said to the doctors, aren't you going to give him an injection? And she said, if I give him an injection, I'll probably kill him, because I was so full of booze. So they stitched me up cold turkey. And I remember my little girl and my wife both crying. And I remember forever, because the blood was running down to my eye. And it was horrendous. And I said, that's it, I'm done. I'm going to get stuck in. And I came back to AA and I started properly. You know, never mind the big bones. I came back and started. And that was about... 78, 79, and I came back and I got stuck into this fellowship, and I did all the things that people say, ashtrays and literature and treasure and all that, and I didn't want to. I was really in a good place, and I was doing lots of intergroup work, and but I didn't want to be a secretary because I didn't feel I was good enough. But I took over at Beaconsfield when I was 5 years sober. I said, I'll do this one. And everything was fine. I was sober just under 9 years. And because I'd been sober at length of time and I'd been doing my work, I'd really done very well. I was now a company director of a £3 million company. And life looked good. But I was going through a very bad period with different things going on in my life. And I came to a meeting one night. There's a bloke there who I didn't particularly care for, but he said something. I wanted to get up and batter him. And I thought, no, you can't do that in here. And I walked off. And I went off into the night. Now, I didn't drink for a year, but I didn't get to a meeting for a whole year. And then one night I'm down the West End with some people from work. Because you're always working, Tony, come with us. And I went down the West End with these people, and there was a bloke there just opened a club. He was an international rugby player, and he was drunk, slavery drunk. He'd been drinking all day on champagne. And, you know, he come up to me, he said, have a man's drink. I was drinking orange juice. I thought, man's drink, you know, champagne, give me a laugh, will you? And anyway, cut long story, I did. I drank that one glass of champagne. And I went, within 3 months, I went from the boardroom to the lunatic asylum at Stone. And I was totally barking mad. I drank to insanity. And I was in there, and the doctors knew. I mean, they took one look at me and they thought, well, you'll do nicely, come in. And I went in there, and I was in there for a little while. And I had to start again. Now, when I came back into AA, I found it very hard, because when I was 9 years sober, or near enough, I used to sit in these chairs and thought, I am sober, I'm very sober, I'll never drink again. I had done the steps to a certain degree, but there were certain steps I never tackled. I never tackled my childhood, never tackled all that violence, because I wasn't in the Northeast any longer. I was in Beaconsfield, for God's sake. And people were posh there. It was a bit like the church. You know what I mean? People didn't go around saying what you're looking at. And and I realised, you know, it was tough. And as I say, even though when I've been sober them years, I thought I'd never drink again. When I had drunk again, I thought, how am I ever going to stop again? I didn't know how I was going to stop again. Because I was driving around with two bottles of vodka in my car, and then I would drink with civilians. You know what I mean? But I had enough stash to keep me going. Anyway, cut long story short, Big Pat, Tom and Terry met in Tom's flat, and they said, Tony, you've got to sort out your childhood, because you ain't going to stay sober for it, you know, for a long time until you do. And I had to go up to, cut long story short, they were right, and I just went back to the meetings day at a time, banging all the meetings in, and quite quickly I started to feel better. But I knew how to do some work on this head. And I went up to Newcastle on Tom's instructions to make amends to my father. Now, my father had kicked 9 balls of shit out of all my brothers. And if anybody owed an apology, it was him to the whole family. However, they're talking about being a selfish program, and I needed to get well, and I needed to get him this rent-free bloke out of my head, you know, the violence. Because when I was getting drunk, I was hanging around lampposts drunk, thinking, I'm going to get the bastard. Now, the bastard was 300 miles away, and an old man, you know. So anyway, I went to Newcastle, and I seen my dad, and when he saw me, I hadn't seen him for a few years, he said, oh, come in, Tony. And he said, sit down, have a cup of tea. And I said, yeah, Dad, I'll have a cup of tea, but I want to talk to you about me being, what I did to you through my drinking. Oh, you're no trouble. I said, Dad, stop. I said, I want to talk to you because obviously I left home badly, and I've drunk, and I've made a mess of my life, and I want to apologise to you. And it stopped there. There's nothing to say anymore, because he couldn't speak, I couldn't speak. And we both cried. And I hugged my father, and he hugged me for the first time in my life. My dad had never, ever hugged me, ever. I'd taken my grandchildren, his grandchildren, he'd never picked any of them up, because it just wasn't his way. You know, when you're fighting in the wars and you're killing people, picking up little babies is not part of the program. And this meeting lasted 15 minutes. And I had to come out of that door, and I got in my car, and I cried for an hour. And all that poison and hate, resentment, just poured out of me. And it was the best thing I ever did. And my dad, that was all done with. And we became friends, if you like, until his death. So he left well. I made amends to all my brothers and sisters, everybody. I did all that properly, which I hadn't done properly. I did it properly. And I've been sober now over 30 years. But I can't tell you the day, because there's one chap, I'll never forget, I went to a meeting, and I was sharing. And he turned around and he said, Tony, the problem with you was that you were too many years sober and not enough days. I thought, you cheeky bastard. You know, I was going to get up again. But he was right. He was absolutely right. Because it's not about being 150 years sober and tap dancing. It's about being sober today. You know, and I've learned that. And that's why I don't actually know when that day was, because I'm just sober today, and I hope to be sober tomorrow. And as I said, because I have been coming to this fellowship over 40 years now. And but to me, it's a fabulous program, but it's a selfish program. You've got to want to have, you must want it. And if you want it, and you're prepared to invest in you, you've got to be selfish, and you've got to pick the best people in these rooms to go and talk to. Because the genuine AA people don't want nothing from you. They don't want money, they don't want a job, they don't want a bunk up, they don't want nothing. All they want is to help you. And they get joy out of that. And I do as well. I get joy helping people. And this is a fabulous fellowship, but you've got to work for it. You've got to do it. And at the end of the day, I wouldn't know if they had audacity to call anybody an alcoholic, because you've got to tell yourself inside, deep down inside, I know I'm not a bad bloke, but I know that once I take alcohol on board, lock out. It's rocking and rolling time. And, I'll become a nutter. I don't know why, but it is. And I know I don't have to be, as long as I don't drink. I've had a very tough year. My wife had cancer, was diagnosed with breast cancer, and stage 3, which was pretty bad. And thank God at the time, she's coming through it, but she's still not very well, but she's come through it. I rang around my family to tell them about my wife, and I found my younger brother had cancer and has since died. I found out one of my older brothers has got cancer, and he's like me, he's an awkward bugger and strong as a horse, and he's fighting it and he's doing okay. So it was quite a year, and this is why I came to the fellowship, and I wasn't always on the ball, because it was tough. I was hurting deep down inside, but I know I am responsible today, to carry this message. But I also knew coming to meetings is the most important thing, and to share. Because when I saw for the first time, I didn't have the courage to share. I was sponsoring people. I couldn't share and tell them I was feeling shitty. I didn't have the courage to do that. But I found it in this fellowship. And as I say, I've come through that. And my oldest brother, I hadn't seen for 41 years, since when I went to Africa in 76. And he just sort of disappeared from the family. And I realise he's an alcoholic as well. And the day my younger brother died, I rang my brothers and sisters, and I wasn't impressed with what they said to me about they're not going to come to the funeral and everything. And I thought, sod this, this is mum's son, this is my brother. And I got in my motor car, and I went to Southend with my wife to find my oldest brother, who had disappeared all them years before. And through the records, and my wife being a good copper, we found his address, and we went to his door. And I met my oldest brother, and I talked to him for the day, and I told him, that our youngest brother's died. Do you want to come to the funeral? No. But the thing was, I told him he had died, and I did my bit, like you do in here. And that's been great for me. It's selfish again, is it? But it's been good for me, because I know that deep down, I've done everything I possibly could for my parents, if you like. And I know today I've got children who I'm very, very proud of. I feel one of my daughters is here today. I don't feel any shame, because I think the only shame in being an alcoholic is still drinking. There's no shame in coming here and saying, look, yeah, I've got this disease, which I do. It just sends me balmy. But I know one day at a time, coming here and helping other people and carrying this message, and it's a wonderful message, and this is a wonderful fellowship. But you've got to want it. You've got to respect the people in the room and the program, it's the best thing that's ever happened to me. So I'm just delighted to be here, and I thank you all of you for keeping me sober one day at a time. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. I thought he was going good for another 5 minutes.
Oh, I need a cup of tea.
Yeah. I tell you, Tony, it's nice your daughter's here, And the thing we don't often talk about, excuse me, is the fact that people get proud of us again, don't they?
Yeah.
Like my story's pretty similar to yours. Like when I come into AA, I had all the police tags and the medical tags and all the shame. And when I found out, cut a long, long story short, for doing my step 4 and 5, and it's very hard to trust someone, isn't it? Open up, because it's the same background, keep your mouth shut, don't say nothing to no one. And when I knew inside, I knew between right and wrong, and And when they said to me that I could see that I come from a background who hit the hardest and shouted the loudest, won arguments, and that I didn't listen, I didn't know anyone listened, you know, and that was like a turning point for my life, because I knew I could be responsible for my actions. Like yourself, I didn't know that once a drink come in, everything's gone, isn't it? You know, and the worst thing about, it's like saying, I can picture, Jimmy A used to say to me, if you can picture yourself drinking with someone, you've got a good chance you'll get identification with them. And I can picture myself drinking with you, you know, the madness, you know, the being a good bloke at the bar, you know, and then going home and not knowing what a Jekyll and Hyde was, you with me? You know, I'd just turn, you know, and it'd only be people that loved me. You know, I could really round up at my mum, meet you in the street and drop it, go off for a drink, total mayhem in the house, and you wouldn't have a clue, you know. And then getting back to mine, Tony, was with my brother. I went into the Fairmont, you know, the asylum, and I was full of shame because I felt like I was a phony in there, you know. Because the worst bit is when you're sober, like you said, clean and sober, we're at the races, aren't we? You know. And I walked right, cut long story short, I didn't know how to speak, I didn't have a voice. And I walked home. And I went round, my mum, we cut a council estate, and I walked round the corner and I see my brother, younger brother, he was bigger brother, you know what I mean, walking towards me, you know, and I was frightened. Because I was thinking, Christ almighty, and I didn't want to fight him. But I knew if he only half hit me, I'm going to lose it with him, you know. And I'll never forget, he walked up to me and he looked at me and he didn't do nothing. And I've never forgotten that break. Because I reckon if we'd have had a row at that moment, if he'd have come out, because I think he showed me what love is. You know, it's like your daughter's here today, you know, like my children, that it's hard. I think my two girls, I'm watching the clock, my two girls come home one night, you know, they're about 18, 19, and they sat down and they was upset. And what it was, some bloke down the pub, I had a drink like you for a while, some fella in the pub told him what I was like drinking. And when you hear it third party from someone else, what your dad's like or what your mum's been like, you know, the truth without love is just a crucifixion, isn't it? That's all I knew the truth. I didn't know no kindness. I didn't know no love. You know, it's like looking at you now, I trust you. You with me? You know, you're here with me. You with me? You know, it's like I'd go talk to someone I first got sober. If you started to yawn and look, I'm off. You know, I was like a cat in a tin roof, you know. But I'm with you. I'm fortunate that I wanted to get sober, and I knew deep down in the truth inside myself I was an alcoholic. I knew it. It's the only way I could accept the damage I'd done to people, you know, the Jekyll and Hyde. And Tommy G, when he 12-stepped me, and he came up to me, I'll never forget, Tony, he said to me, did you pay him all the money for your drinking, son? Did you pay with your self-respect? Have you become a liar? Are you a thief? You know, and it's that acceptance at the gut level, isn't it? You know, I did. You know, and getting out, and then it's not easy, is it? But it's like you said, you've got to want it. You know, it's like sitting up here. There's a bit of me sitting up here, and I'm thinking, what am I doing here? You know, and it's like what Jack Brown used to say in them tapes, you know, my body's here, but my mind wants to be over there. You know, I want to be somewhere else. I don't want to be here, you know, and it's like you've got to be where you are. You've got, as American women, you see, you've got to blossom where you're planted. You know, stop running away, and thank you for turning up, Tony. You know, thank you everyone that's here for turning up, and especially you, John. I was starting to brick it. You, John, at the back. I think we got the foot. Eh?
Is that Irish John?
Yeah.
I'm
gone
for that. So was I.
Yeah, that's two of us are worried about it because we've got the first two speakers. And I thought, where's the third one? You know, but we can have a cup of tea down. Yeah. So if we're not organised here. There's not enough of us really to talk. So we can have a cup of tea. And if you could come straight back in again, and then Teresa will come up and speak, yeah? Okay.
Good.
All right, we'll have a cup of tea. And the toilets are on the other side, yeah? Can you stop this, James, yeah?
Yep.
Well, Tony.
Good. Oh, well.
You're doing good, my mate.
Good.